Our gracious God, we're so thankful that You love us, that You're with us, that You give us these days, these Lord's days, time to come together, to open Your Word, to be refreshed, to be built up, to be taught, to be encouraged, to be directed and helped. Lord, I do pray now that You would help me as I speak, to give me grace to teach the truth in love. You cause Your Word to do its good work in everyone here and everyone who hears and listens. I ask this for the sake of Your name and glory, and pray in the name of the Lord Jesus, Your Son. Amen. All right, we'll be back in Ecclesiastes again. So turn there to the end of chapter 9. As we're making our way through this great book, we come now to this portion where Solomon, the preacher, as he calls himself, rather than the king, he's preaching, he's given a word, a message from God for us. And so here we have him in Ecclesiastes chapter 9. We're just going to pick up now in verse 17 and just work our way through. Just work through these verses. Some of them aren't as closely connected in thought, but in general, we keep in mind the overarching theme even of Ecclesiastes, which is basically everything is vanity in the sense of being meaningless or temporary in this life. Also, there's a lot to be said in Ecclesiastes about wisdom and folly. And so he picks up now, right after he had spoken about this amazing event, about this poor wise man who, by his wisdom, delivered this small town or small city from a great and powerful king. Remember that? So now he says this in chapter 9, verse 17. He says, I'll read verse 17 and 18. He says, "The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good." All right. Now here we have a couple of better than statements. He had made these throughout the book, hasn't he? Better is this than that. Better is the good name than, you know, these other things. Better is the day of death and the day of birth, and on and on. Here we have a couple of more better than statements. And Solomon says, the words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Now, this is something that has always been true and will always be true. From the moment of the fall in Genesis to today, this is the case. Better are the words of the wise heard in quiet than the shouting of fools. Now, most of us can relate to this, or at least picture in our mind or think of a situation or a scenario with some ruler and in his speech, in a loud way, a shouting among fools, as is said here. But if you think about that, what has really come? What really has been done that's good or come about from a ruler shouting among a crowd, especially one that may be gullible, worldly, not very thoughtful? They sink into this crowd think mentality, and you got this shouting ruler. What really good has come about from those on the world stage? You'd probably be pretty hard pressed to think of three or four, right, occasions. Well, we have that where even biblically you have someone like Nebuchadnezzar or Herod, you know, these great kings. Look at me. Look how great my kingdom is. Look at what I've done. And then on and on. My government's going to be the best. We're going to become the greatest and all of this. Usually it's full of rhetoric, right? Empty rhetoric, hot air, or just buzzwords or catchphrases that really don't have much meaning or weight. It's just meant to sound good, in a sense, but there's no real substance. Well, we have that in a way, and then we have the quiet place and someone with wisdom speaking. And it could be a wise parent, grandparent, aunt, uncle, a good friend. You're in a living room, perhaps, having a quiet conversation, thinking carefully, talking, or it might be a Bible study, prayer meeting, on and on. How much good has come from that kind of thing on a world stage? The salt of the earth throughout, you see, it permeates and it does great good. The value of that kind of thing, the comparison, really, it's not even to be compared, is it? Of the good that comes, the benefit received, the blessing, the lasting consequences that come from that kind of thing versus one, shouting ruler. Well, wise words, words from wisdom, what do? They build up, they edify, they bring about clarity in a situation. Or they bring truth, they bring understanding. They instruct, they teach, they give direction, they give proper direction. So the contrast, it's also, like I said, to this, the loudness or the intensity of a ruler or a person of authority, an authoritative person. And you have that versus the quiet, the calm with really anyone who has wisdom. See that? You could really say this is God's way versus the world's way. The world thinks, I'm in charge, I'm in control, and I'm gonna shout to the point where you do what I want. But you're talking to people who are really fools, and it doesn't always work out that way. Well, the New King James phrases it this way, and I thought it was very helpful. The New King James says, words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard rather than the shout of a ruler among fools. So if you're going to listen to one or the two, you better listen to the wise person who's even said it quietly. It's been mentioned quietly, calmly. If you're going to hear one of the two, that's the idea that the New King James kind of gives. And it's the same truth. If you're going to listen to one, much better, far better, the words of the wise. I don't know if many of you, even in your minds now, may have thought of, remember Adolf Hitler? It's interesting the way this guy keeps coming up, where in the history of the world, the most memorable person who's done the greatest harm, but he was this unimposing man in stature with dark hair, a little mustache, black dark mustache, who would rant, rail, and give these powerful speeches, bragging on the greatness of the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Aryan warrior class of the greatest, race of mankind. A little bit of irony there. But what was his effectiveness? How was he so effective? He was like, he got really loud and he could argue points that he had in his mind very articulately, but loudly and with passion. But this is incredible. And he had weapons of war, didn't he? And did great damage. But look at this. Even, I'm not connecting these necessarily, but he says this in verse 18. He says, wisdom is better than weapons of war. Well, remember the scene before this, the poor wise man. He said, by his wisdom delivered this little town from this great king with a powerful army. And he did mention the weapons, the great siege works. Well, he, by his wisdom, delivered that city. It was a perfect illustration of what Solomon's summing up here in verse 18. That wisdom truly is better or more effective than military weapons. Weapons of war. Now, I wouldn't be up here advocating or saying, the United States military ought to get rid of all their weapons. Let's just be smart about things. I mean, I'm not saying that. And he's not saying that either. He's just making the statement that the point is the value of wisdom. And wisdom, it does have its limits. It can't solve all the problems in life, right? It can't figure out everything, or it can't understand all there is to understand in the world. What God has made crooked, even since the fall in Genesis, Wisdom can't fix it all, but wisdom truly is better than even something like weapons of war. Now, I paused here and thought, well, why would he use that as an example? What are weapons of war even good for? What's the use of them? Any ideas here? Just a Bible study. We can interact. What's the common use? Or they're good, even. Because weapons of war aren't a bad thing. I mean, in a way, right? If you're using them for good, what could they be used for? Self-defense? The defense of your nation? Or what else? I put two things. Self-defense and enforcing of justice. Can y'all think of anything else? Destruction? Death. Right. Well, you get the idea. And wisdom is better than this, but, you know, you could make the argument that it takes wisdom to even create these weapons of war. Because a nation that has a good government, you would want them to have the best weapons of war, wouldn't you? And you would want them to use wisdom. It takes wisdom in using them properly. Whereas you have a Hitler who did not. And we see what happened there in the worst world war that has ever hit the world. Well, there's another aspect in the fallen world that he says in the second part of 18, verse 18, he says, one sinner destroys much good. One sinner destroys much good. So on one hand, you have one poor wise man who did great good, didn't he? And delivered that city. But on the other hand, you have one sinner that can destroy much good. See, he brings in some balance here in this whole thing. And I think what he's saying, the point he's saying is that wisdom, even though it's so good and so valuable, it is extremely vulnerable. It's very valuable, but wisdom is extremely vulnerable. It's not indestructible. And even the works of it that have occasioned in the past can easily be destroyed. That's a profound reality in this world, isn't it? How much good can be ruined by one act of folly? One foolish sin. It's incredible. One sinner, think of it, from Adam, from the very beginning, the first sin, the damage, destruction, and death that brought into the whole world. There is one person. And this is the reality today. And so I think he's getting across that the damage, the destruction from one sinner cannot be overestimated. You know, when you sin, an act of folly. Now this is what it's foolishness at work. It never or rarely ever affects only you. You see, it has this ripple effect, and sometimes those ripples get really big, but it never affects just you. Others are always impacted. This destroys the idea of, you know, a little sin might have a little impact. And that's simply not the case. A little sin can destroy much good. And one sinner can work destruction against great wisdom. So this brings him now to an effective picture, very memorable word picture from chapter 10 as we move now into chapter 10, verse 1. Look at what he says. He says, dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. So a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. All right. This is one of those that has stuck in my mind, the dead flies and the perfume picture. It's very memorable, isn't it? It's very impactful. The perfumer's ointment. I mean, it's this substance that's intended to be used for good, right? To give off a sweet smelling, just a pleasing aroma, used for various occasions. In various events, but you see the intent of it. It's obvious. Everyone can relate to this. The perfume, meant for good, meant for the pleasing aroma, meant for the pleasing, clean, nice, approachable smell. And here we have the something good and then this dead fly, or more than one, floating in the bottle. And now it isn't sweet and pleasing, but it's the opposite. The exact opposite. It stinks. It gives off a stench. Those dead flies, what do? They putrefy the perfume. That's an interesting word. If you think of it, that's what sin, a little folly, does. It putrefies. And so we have these nasty little dead things floating around in a good thing. And it ruins it all. Why? Because now the whole thing stinks. It's utterly useless now. So this is a word picture. Again, the scriptures use word pictures all the time. And it's pointing to a greater truth. We're not in here to learn about perfume today, are we? And Solomon's not trying to, like, make us real savvy about how perfume works and you keep flies out of it. That's not the point. It's just a picture that points to a greater reality, a far greater truth. And the Lord Jesus would do this at times, wouldn't he? He would take something from nature that everyone can relate to and understand, and he'd apply a greater spiritual truth to it, a more profound reality about that in your life. And this is the way it is here. It's the picture of how little acts of folly, little sins, can wreck a person's reputation or their life. That's it. And we know this. Little things, a little act of foolishness, seemingly little, or maybe just one act of foolishness, can just wreck everything. Derek Kidner, a commentator from Cambridge long ago, anyway, he said this. He said, it takes far less to ruin something than to create it. Takes far less to ruin something than to create it. He also said, it is far easier to create a stink than to create sweetness. Don't you know that's true? Way easier to create a stink than to create sweetness. This is the fallen world we live in. One little bad decision can ruin you. It can ruin your reputation, at least. Or it could wreck a marriage. One thing. I've known people. They made one slip. They did one thing, and it ruined the marriage. Well, I mean, those little statements or those actions that you say in a moment of anger or frustration, or even when things are going well, you know, boom, it just comes in and just destroys the peace. We know this, don't we? But this is important. This is what God's wanting us to think about today. And it's pretty amazing. You can do a lot of things right, can't you? You can make many good choices that have led you to a good place, but then in drops the dead fly. And the dead flies, you let your guard down. You aren't thoughtful, or you neglect basic spiritual disciplines. You make a bad choice rooted in whatever, selfishness or pride or weariness or loneliness or anger or on and on. And now the perfume is ruined. It's ruined in total. And it gives off this repulsiveness instead of a pleasant and attractive aroma. One time my grandfather told me, he said, now think of having this nice tall glass of water, just the purest spring water, clean, that you can imagine. And you would take it and drink it in an instant and enjoy it and be refreshed. He said, but what if you saw me take a drop of sewage or, say, deadly poison, one drop, and now hand it to you? Would you drink that? Obviously, no. What did that do? It ruined the whole thing. It just destroyed the whole thing. You wouldn't even want it. Now, notice, the way he says it is, it outweighs. That's an interesting word to note. And it outweighs. A little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. The stink is overwhelming. It's overpowering the good. So you have a, let's say you have a scale. This is a clear, you've got two sides of the scale and a big stack of wisdom, honor, good things on this side. And on this side of the scale, you take a little folly and it tips the scale. It outweighs that. Isn't that incredible? Is that how you're reading it? Just a little of it tips the scales. Well, let's keep moving here. Look at what he says in verse 2 to 3. Chapter 10, he says, "A wise man's heart inclines him to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. Even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks sense. And he says to everyone that he's a fool." All right. Well, here's a contrast. This is a contrast, right? It's between the way of life between a wise man and a foolish man. And it's very simple in a way. The different choices that people make in life will reflect whether you're a wise person or a foolish person. He says a wise man's heart, his heart, that would be, as we've talked about before, the control center. The control center of your life, the control center of how you think about things, how you feel, the actions you take in life. A wise man's heart inclines him to the right, it says. Or more literally, perhaps the right hand. Well, that's worth talking about a second. The right hand, it's a Hebrew idiom. And it referred to a place of protection or stability. That's what the right hand is signifying. A place of protection, stability, or even strength and soundness. You see, the son of my right hand, he would say at times in other places, at God's right hand. Well, the wise go from strength to strength. That's what he's saying. He understands things rightly, accurately. He's led in the right direction. So his thinking and his actions that follow don't lead him astray. The wise man's heart is to the right, inclines him to the right. For one thing, he's wise, right? So what does that mean? What's the beginning of wisdom? The fear of the Lord. He fears God. So he's going to walk in wisdom now. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And he's going to now be protected in this sense, walk in God's ways. Even as Psalm 16, at the end of Psalm 16 says, at God's right hand, or what? Pleasures forevermore. In his presence is fullness of joy. So this is the idea. A person whose heart inclines them to the right, that's what they're going to do. They're going to be walking in God's ways. And it's going to be a life, ultimately, of joy. And on the other hand, no pun intended there, on the other hand, the foolish man's heart leads him in the opposite direction. That's what he's saying. To the left. He goes that way. His lack of wisdom leaves him vulnerable. And now he's open to all kinds of destruction, dangers, problems, because he's not walking in God's ways. Now, the left, it's also kind of the idea, even with the Jewish idiom aspect of fumbling, incompetence, weakness even. So any of you here that may be left-handed, don't be offended. It's just a way of expressing the ideas in this. And the fool, he says in his heart, as the psalmist says, what? There is no God. The fool, he says in his heart, there is no God. So his thinking already is corrupt. And he's not going to walk in God's ways. He's not going to walk in the ways, really, of wisdom. So basically, the wise person goes that way, and the fool goes that way. The wise person's heart protects him. He's under this idea, this strength and protection, blessing, ultimately joy. But the fool is always going to get into trouble. One way or another, eventually they will get into trouble. And Solomon says, he says this, even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks sense. And he says to everyone that he's a fool. Well, what does he mean here? When he walks on the road, he's not talking about, hey, look at the way John is walking on Main Street there. I can tell he's a fool. That's not what it means, right? Walking on the road, it's a summary statement for just a basically a person's behavior in the simple or ordinary aspects of life. Not the complicated and things like that, but the simple, ordinary aspects of life, a fool is going to be exposed. The way he lives, the words they say. Now, that's a big one, right? Because the fool may appear to be wise until they start talking, right? That's what the Proverbs say. They start talking and talking and talking, and it becomes clear this is a foolish person. Or the way they, the things they're interested in, the way they do their work or their behavior in just in general, the things they're entertained by, the way that they treat other people, it's all going to be communicated and proving that they're a fool. And he says to everyone that he's a fool, that everyone there would be those who aren't fools, those who have some sense. They're going to be able to tell. Now, this is a warning even to young people or children. If your parents ever tell you, listen, don't go here, don't hang out with this person or that person, because I've been watching them. I know them. I know what they're like. Don't do that. It would be very wise to follow their instructions. Because bad company corrupts good morals, right? And on and on and on. But it's obvious, the discerning person, the one who has wisdom and sense can see this is the case. This is a fool. It's not an insult, it's a reality. People are either wise or they're fools, right? That's the way the scriptures portray people, mankind. And Solomon, right here, in essence, he's saying the fool cannot conceal himself. Just can't do it. The fool can't conceal himself, and fools will always go on the wrong road. Always. Now look at verse 4. Now these aren't as closely connected now. It takes a little puzzling out how this all flows, I admit. It's not the easiest Bible study even for me to piece together. But if we look at verse 4, he says, if the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. Now, here Solomon, he kind of drops in an example, a life situation for how you behave wisely rather than foolishly. And it's a scenario of when he says a ruler gets upset with you and directs his anger at you. What are you going to do? How are you going to react? How are you going to behave? And he says, do not leave your place. In other words, don't quit. At least not right away. Don't quit. Don't leave your position. Don't desert. Don't walk off the job. Don't storm off in a huff. Don't do that. Now, granted, there may be a conscience issue where this is dangerous. Okay, that's... set that aside. That's not what he's talking about. He's just directing his anger at you. He's frustrated. So don't walk off in a huff. Again, Derek Kidner says, while it may feel good to instantly resign, on principle, it is a display of pride, and ultimately less impressive and more immature than it feels. Think about that. He says, now, it's less impressive to just walk off in a huff in a situation like that. Do you know what is impressive? Calmness at that moment. Calmness. Remaining calm. Keeping your composure. A cool spirit. Having a gentle, conciliatory attitude. That's impressive. That's always impressive. And, you know, the root meaning, you may even see a footnote in this verse, the root meaning of the word calmness is actually healing. Calmness really does bring healing, at least to a heated scenario, situation. There is impressive strength in this. An emotionally charged situation. This is walking in wisdom. This is consistent with the Proverbs that Solomon even said, with patience a ruler may be persuaded, and a soft tongue will do what? Break a bone. Again, it's a word picture. God doesn't want you going around breaking people's bones. But it'll break the bone of that emotionally charged situation. You see? Your calmness, your composure, your conciliatory attitude. This is the way to bring about peace. Laying the great offense to rest. And, you know, think about this. It may be that you have messed up. You have made a mistake. You have erred. You have done something wrong. And now the ruler, the one who has authority, is frustrated, angry, and venting it at you. Okay? Well, in that situation, if you can stay composed, don't run off in a huff and quit, that kind of thing, and use conciliatory, patient, calm words, you're going to be a great blessing to him or her, and yourself, and ultimately others. Now, if you did not do anything wrong, but you're just in the way, kind of the ruler, the one in authority, is just frustrated and angry about something, kind of like Daniel in the book of Daniel, and this king is just so frustrated and angry and tormented, really, about the dreams he's been having, and he wants people to figure it out. He's venting it at them. This is the kind of thing. Daniel is exemplary in this. He stayed composed. He stayed calm. And the way he spoke, you know, if the wise men were to say, give us a night to think about it, and that night they get together and say, you know what, let's saddle up and bolt out of here. We got to fly. That would have been horrible, wouldn't it? That would have been the wrong approach. That would have been even dangerous for them. It would have been a problem on all kinds of levels. But he didn't. So this is what he's talking about. And this principle really does apply to all of us. Don't sit here thinking, well, I don't answer to a king or some governmental ruler. No one does that to me or confronts me like that. But we do have employers, right? And various other forms of authority in our lives. And we definitely get into emotionally charged situations, don't we? You can't live in this world and avoid them, right? You know, so what are you going to do when the anger comes your way? You're going to get upset? You're going to run off in a huff? Are you going to quit? You're going to quit the relationship? Whatever. You see how that goes? Run away, rebel. Or will you have this calm, peaceable, conciliatory attitude? Now, which, by the way, I'm going to throw in a parenthesis. I just had a thought. This is why I'm studying Ecclesiastes personally, because I have not mastered this. I'm not perfect in this. Ask this row of people over here and they'll confirm that. But I need this. You need this. And we need to grow in this. Because when you, in a situation like that, if you can stay calm, conciliatory, have calm words, kind words, then this is always impressive and it's always going to exude a pleasing aroma. See that? It is. This is good perfume, so to speak. And there is an old Puritan, Thomas Chalmers, he said this. He said, "The charm of yielding is worthy of being specially noted. The power over the spirit is a far higher glory than an earthly triumph. A victory over ourselves is more glorious than a victory over others." Now that's godly thinking. I'll show you. You know, you vent back, you put them in their place. I'll show you, boss. I'm done, or whatever. You can get victory over your own spirit, your own composure, your own heart. If you can get victory there, that is glorious. And that is a blessing. Proverbs 16:32. Some of you may be thinking about this. Whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty. Right? He who rules his spirit is better than he who takes a city. Well, that's where we want to grow, isn't it? That's where we need to grow. If our church could grow in this, how much more effective would we be, even in our community, in our workplaces, in our homes? The thriving, the blessing, just incredible. That's a victory worth fighting for there. Now, we keep moving into verses 5 through 7, and this is all I have time for today. But it says, there's an evil that I've seen under the sun, as it were an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich sit in the low place. I've seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves. So here, verse 5 speaks of another evil Solomon has seen under the sun. He says that in Ecclesiastes, I've seen this evil under the sun, I've seen that evil under the sun. Here's another one. And it's an error made, he says. It's an error, which would mean that the evil that comes from this error, this decision, really was unintentional. It's unintentional, but it's blameworthy. It's an error. It's an unforeseen mistake from a ruler again, someone who's in authority, someone who has a position of power. And look what it is. He says, folly is set in many high places. Well, what does he mean? It's a ruler someone with authority who puts a fool in charge of things. That's what it means. He gives a fool a very important job. Or he promotes them to high positions and delegates authority to them. Happens all the time. Especially in government, right? But in other workplaces it happens. You know, just think of a CEO perhaps may give a big vice president job or director job or some to someone just because they're a friend. Or it's maybe because they fit a certain protected class and they have to meet a superficial social quota, right? Am I speaking nonsense here? This happens. But it turns out that there isn't the required experience or wisdom in that person. And ultimately, those put in these high positions, they don't have that wisdom and they're going to make a mess. I mean, Solomon says this is evil. God says it is. God says it through Solomon. You know, in a critical moment, when the pressure comes, right? When the heat is on and it's going to come, the critical mistake will be made. It will be. And this person will turn out to be a fool. They'll do just like verse 4 says not to do. And on and on. They'll make the foolish decision. It will negatively impact many others. Not just them, but many. The one will destroy much good, right? And what makes this so bad is that there are wise and qualified people for that spot, and you pass them over. That's bad. That's wrong. That is just fundamentally wrong. And he's saying the proper order of things have been turned upside down, and it's going to make a big mess. Matthew Henry, love him. He says, men of shattered brains and broken fortunes are put in places of power and trust, while the rich men of good sense and good estates, whose interest would oblige them to be true to the public and whose abundance would likely set them above temptations to bribery and extortion, yet sit in low places and can get no preferment. Now, so this is what he means when he refers to the rich sitting in low places and princes on the ground, slaves on horses, that kind of thing. He's talking about the culture of the day and how people had these positions of authority. And it's not meant to be bigoted or saying those who are poor are fools or live foolishly or anything like that. I mean, Joseph, for example, would be a good example of how he was poor in Egypt, right? He was a slave and in prison. He was poor, but he was raised to a position of authority. But that's different. Why was he raised to a position of authority? Because he had wisdom, wisdom from God, and the king saw it. Now, this is what Solomon's talking about is you've got a Joseph, but you're passing him over to put in this person just because you're trying to meet some superficial demand, or you've got a buddy, or you've got, you see, you're passing over the Joseph to put him in charge. So that's the idea. It's just a general idea that those who have great wealth, even, you know, it says the rich, what that's communicating is these people with wealth have made wise use, typically, wise use of their time, their money, their energy, their education, and they brought about fruitful and beneficial returns. They've made great gains in life. So if you put them in charge, the chances are they're going to do the same for whatever you've got them doing, right? That's the idea. And that's just reality. Well, according to Solomon, any king or president or ruler who does this kind of thing is doing evil. He just is. And God's going to judge it. And those who cause this will cause others to suffer. So let me just end here. Make sure. Aren't you thankful for the gospel of grace, though? Even thinking about this, the dead flies. Aren't you glad for the gospel of grace, the cleansing? We all have let dead flies get into our perfume, haven't we? Some of us could say, I've let dead frogs in my perfume, or elephants. We've got little sins and big sins, all. And we've abandoned our post sometimes. We've stepped out of line, right? We've stormed off in a huff when we needed to show calmness and composure and kindness. We've vented in anger. We've done it, right? But this is how I think of it. Christ has redeemed us and washed us clean and given us our renewed mind and a new heart. And we have fallen short of the glory of God. We have ruined our aroma even unto God on many occasions. But Christ cleanses us. He washes us. He forgives. So now that we are redeemed, if you're a believer, now that you are redeemed, let's learn to walk in God's ways. That's why we're studying Ecclesiastes, to walk in wisdom in God's ways, for our hearts to incline us to the right and not to the left. Amen.